Today, new year, same old problems. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Tarek Brooker, journalist. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
I'm pretty good. Hanging in there, but I was amazed at all of this talk about the new world happening in the new year. It looks like the old world's still there.
Well, we've been hearing it since sort of about February or March that, you know, 2021's going to be better, 2021's going to be different. And here we are, and, you know, same old, same old. You know, the virus is still here and people are storming the US Capitol.
Just throw that a little thought in about the US. And, of course, the virus seems to be a little bit more potent, and we're getting spot fires in various places across Australia. Brisbane's now locked down for 3 days in and around, area of the city and in the immediate surroundings. Where do you want to start the conversation? Because I reckon we could talk for about 8 hours and all of this stuff.
Oh, we certainly could. I think a good place to start would be on the issues with the virus at the moment. Because, you know, there's some news in the UK, I mean, that's come out, and they've said that there's concerns from some of the chief scientific advisors to the Prime Minister that the vaccine may not be effective against the South African strain of the virus, or if it is effective, it may be reduced to effectiveness.
Yes. Now, of course, everyone's been hanging out for the vaccine as the solution to the virus, right? And of course, a lot of money and effort and time has been put in around the world to try and create these solutions. But of course, they are quite specific based on the particular profile of the virus at a particular point in time. So the question is, how far is it morphing and how far will it continue to morph? And I don't know whether you saw, but there was also some mention of a new strain over in Wuhan.
No, I haven't heard about that. As a matter of fact, that's news to me. But it's just this. I think what's a little bit concerning at the moment with all this stuff surrounding the virus is the number of people who are going out there and saying we know definitively that this is not going to have any problem with the new vaccine, that it's all going to be fine. Now, very, very few scientists worth their salt who believe in the sort of old world scientific method of actually having a hypothesis and then testing that hypothesis would actually act in that way. So, you know, the more sort of circumspect, more scientific scientists, shall we say, are, you know, wanting to run these tests and, you know, figure out for certain before they make all these promises. And I might have said this before on your show, but I think this is arguably the greatest moment of moral hazard in the history of the world.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that we are getting more and more confused between communicating optimistic messages and pure science and politics. All of the three things seem to have got a bit scrambled, right? Because, yeah, there is a scientific method which basically says we come up with a hypothesis, we test it, and we see whether we're right or whether we're wrong, and then we go on and do it again and again, right? We seem to have short-circuited that quite a few times. And I noticed that the politicians are still saying, well, I'm taking advice from, the health professionals. I noticed in the UK, for example, there was clearly some tussle going on between politics and health and politics over there, you know, and it feels to me as though Boris finally got bounced into doing something better late than never, as it were. This is not normal, and I'm just concerned a bit with you that we are actually sitting on the precipice and we could be facing significant issues as a result of it.
Yeah, we could. I mean, all of these economic forecasts are predicated on the idea by sort of mid this year, you know, sort of end of Q2, middle of Q3, that we're going to have the vast majority of the Western world's population inoculated against the virus, and that everything's going to be fine. Now, let's just hypothetically say that the vaccines continue to be effective, that there's no problems with the rollout, that everything is hunky dory as they claim. I mean, I really don't think that we're just going to suddenly go from this struggle that we're currently undergoing, economically speaking, to this fanciful world where everything's fantastic. I mean, Jeremy Grantham had a great article out, I think it was 2 or 3 days ago, in which he basically said that once the vaccine arrives, that's when you're really going to start to see, you know, the economy for what it is, because the stimulus is going to be removed and, you know, the political impetus for further stimulus is basically going to evaporate. And then you're just left with this hole where the stimulus used to be.
Yes. Well, I think you and I have argued several times that the reason the economy is where it is because of all the stimulus. The reason the stock markets are so buoyant is simply all that liquidity being flooded into it. And the money's got to go somewhere. So that's going into the financial markets. And, you know, the financial markets are saying, hey, no problem here. All-time highs in the US and, you know, even strong here in Australia. When the tide goes out in terms of stimulus, I wonder what's going to be left.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, at the moment, we've seen about $300 billion worth of stimulus flow into the economy since all this started back in, you know, February, March. And the scale of it is just enormous. I mean, New South Wales alone is going to spend more on stimulus, around $29 billion, than Rudd did on cash handouts during the GFC, which was around $21 billion. Now, even if you want to play with an inflation calculator and do all those just different things and work out what proportion of the economy it was, we're still talking big, big amounts of cash. I mean, the last time Australia was spending this much money relative to GDP, we had the fourth largest Air Force and the fourth largest Navy in the world, because that's where the money went, beating Hitler and beating the Japanese. But this time we have bugger all to show for it, except some higher corporate profits and jobs that I'm not really sure are going to, all of them are going to be there when all of this is finally removed. Because, you know, never before in history has this much stimulus been withdrawn without there being a recession. That is, you know, in Australian history, it's a historical fact. I mean, people say, oh, but when it was withdrawn after World War II, oh, that's because of the change from the wartime economy. Yeah, sure, I agree. That particular part of the recession was. But what people don't understand or seemingly overlook is that the recession wasn't just 1945, 40, you know, early part of 1946. It was 1946 and 1947. So, you know, it just doesn't compute to me, but, you know, what do I know?
Well, I've got this theory, and let me throw it at you, see what you think, right? I think we're in what's called MMT by proxy, right? There was a very strong argument over the last two or three years to say we need to throw a lot of stimulus into the economy to support the economy, and, you know, the old eternal verities of how to make an economy work may be questionable, right? But there was also a strong set of resistance to that, insofar that, well, that was a long way off the dial in terms of traditional ways of thinking, right? In a way, it seems to me that this has been a perfect creation of using the MMT type thinking, throw a lot of liquidity in and see what happens, right? So there were issues in the economy before the virus, right? A lot of liquidity thrown in through the virus, but not necessarily in areas that is going to create sustainable value. So when the stimulus is removed, if it is removed, and that's a question mark, I think it will be extended, frankly. I can't see how it cannot be without significant economic damage. We're in this new world where effectively we'll look back and think, oh, actually, we've been MMT'd.
To take a whole load of petrol and throw it on the fire, I really think that this entire sort of last, say, 9 months has really, really screwed things up for the MMT people, to be completely honest with you. Not because it's shown that it doesn't necessarily work, but more the fact that it's shown what governments will do when they have it.
Yep.
Rather than taking MMT and turning it into a universal basic income, which is designed to be tapered using taxation or using it towards, you know, building, you know, nation building infrastructure, we've just thrown it at corporations. We've thrown it at retail, and that's all we've done with it. Rather than doing all the things that MMT advocates talk about, like, you know, building social housing, building transport infrastructure, hospitals, schools, etc., that's not what's happened. So in a lot of ways, they've really done a great job completely discrediting the idea of MMT working in the real world. Not because it's impossible with ideal governance, but when you have real world governance with people like, say, Scott Morrison or Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell or Boris Johnson, it doesn't work.
Well, that's exactly the point I was trying to make, right? Which was there are two elements to the MMT. The first is you can't think of a government balance sheet the same way as a household balance sheet. It is okay to effectively borrow, et cetera, et cetera. And it is sustainable to do that if you actually structure it right, right? So, well, that's, we're certainly borrowing a lot. So that's, you know, proven. And interest rates are really low, so it's not costing us an arm and a leg yet. But the other side of it is what you do with it, right? It's where you make the MMT investments. And that's where, if you're absolutely right, what's actually happened in practice is that the money has been thrown to the normal parts of the crowd, you know, the top end of town and big business, etc., etc. None of it is actually investment for the long term. We've discussed this before, but, you know, it's worth underlining again. None of this is really investing, laying the foundation for a new, better economy into the long term, or as you say, UBR, whatever it is. So we've got actually the worst of two worlds, because we actually have all the debt, but we don't have the potential growth impact of the structured investments that were actually the other part of MMT. So I agree with you. I think it's sort of, like I said, MMT by proxy.
Yeah, and it's not even the good kind of MMT. I mean, you know, if people want to, you know, if people wanted to try MMT as they as it's sort of envisioned in the ideal world scenario, you know, that's something that I'd be interested in seeing, you know, done on a pilot type scale. But, you know, just before, you know, everyone flames me to death in the comments, but what we're seeing now is just very much not that. And I don't think, I mean, say for example, in the US, it's created these unrealistic expectations. 65% of Americans, when polled, said that they support getting $2,000 a month stimulus checks for every man, woman, and child until the pandemic is finally over. Now, that's insane. Now, like, I'm generally on the side of the, you know, deflation, you know, outside of, you know, food and a few other, commodities. But to be completely honest, if Biden's going to keep throwing $2,000 at every man, woman, and child in America every few months, until the economy gets back on its feet, we are going to see inflation, you know, at least in that sort of short-term time window, because you're going to have all this demand and not enough supply.
Yeah. So it's clear, I think, that it's likely Biden will get majority in both houses, right? Looks like that's the way it's looking, which means that, and the markets are banking on this, one of the reasons why the stock markets went up rather than down when all the shenanigans happened yesterday in the US, it's because the expectation is that Biden will actually lead significantly more stimulus into the economy. Whether it's the right sort of stimulus, you know, as we discussed, well, that's pretty questionable. But the question is, does that lead to better economic outcomes over the medium and long term? And give me an example of where it has. I can't find any.
It's because there isn't one.
Ah.
I mean, you know, in fairness, you know, the Japanese have tried throwing money at the economy periodically.
Yep.
You know, for what, nearly 30 years?
Yeah.
Over 30 years, yep, now since 1989.
Yep.
You know, they've done it. The Europeans have done it. I mean, realistically, it's not going to create the kind of positive feedback loop that you get when you invest in nation building infrastructure, in things that actually grow the parts of the economy that are productive. I mean, all you end up with is sugar hit after sugar hit after sugar hit. And that's what you've seen in Japan. Every time, you know, they'll inject some stimulus, there'll be a sugar hit. The Japanese government will raise sales tax in order to try and start recouping some of what, you know, what they've injected. And then it all just falls over all over again. And then it's just, oh, we'll try it again, but this time we'll call it Abenomics instead of just throwing shed loads of money at the economy.
Yeah, and that is really the point. So far as I can see, there is no exit path out of this, right? And, you know, if I take some of the Scandinavian countries, for example, Denmark, who's also been at this for quite some time, they've had negative rates, I think, since 2012 or some silly thing like that, right? Now they've got a mortgage rate of 0% for 20 years. Well, how weird is that, right? We are in a situation where some of the standard assumptions around the way the economy work is really being questioned. And I still worry about whether we actually really understand the implications of what we're doing here, because what we've really done is we've actually taken the fundamental view of how markets work and, you know, capital should go to areas where it can actually create more returns, all those sorts of things. None of that exists anymore. We're in a whole new world which is being top-down controlled, top-down supported by massive amounts of liquidity, but I don't think there's a clear plan as to, one, where is it going to lead? And two, how do we get out of it?
No, we're stuck in this sort of, I like to sort of look at it as, you know, you're sort of trying to cross this big cavernous, you know, canyon, and there's this path across, and it starts out very, very wide, and you go, oh, that's not too bad, we can do that. And as we're getting, you know, as we go further into the future, the path is just getting narrower and narrower and narrower, to the point where it's basically just one false move and the whole thing will just fall over, and you just fall into the cavern, and that's, you know, the canyon, and that's it. And I think that's really the crux of the problem at the moment. You know, we're seeing bond yields rise in the US and elsewhere as a result of Biden's election and the market pricing in, you know, this wave of stimulus that it's expecting. Mm. But by the same token, it's like if bond yields rise, stocks are eventually going to get hit. Borrowing costs are going to rise for companies and for sovereigns, and then you're going to have a debt crisis. So you're sort of stuck in a situation where bond yields have to stay low, but you want the economy to fire at the same time. But if the economy fires, then bond yields have to rise. So you're stuck in this really, really difficult Goldilocks situation where if the economy ever does anything more than sort of, you know, happily stagnate with, you know, sort of relatively low real levels of growth, you're stuffed. Mm. So that's sort of the problem as I see it. And I don't really know how more people aren't just going, oh, crap. If things actually do accelerate, if they do actually get inflation in the US and they have to raise rates, if the market forces a rise in rates, whether the Fed will actually raise the overnight rate is another matter, but the bond market's going to do its own thing anyway.
Yes, I think the bond market is a very good forward indicator. But, you know, I'd also say, well, buy Bitcoin then. That's the answer. I mean, everybody else is at the moment, surely.
That puts me in a difficult position. I say something positive, I'm going to get flamed. I say something negative, I'm going to get flamed. You know, I've very much tried to extricate myself from the whole Bitcoin debate. No, it's just emblematic of the where the market's at more broadly, though, isn't it?
It is, and that's the point. I mean, if you look at the Bitcoin price, you know, it's gone very, very high again, of course, and will continue probably for some time, right? We know a few things. We know that a lot of people who got those government checks put it into Bitcoin, right? So there are a lot of new investors. We also know that the momentum is being reinforced by some of the financial services sector companies that are actually big investors now, and you know, PayPal and those sorts of things. So there is a sort of set of structural dynamics that's actually driving it higher. But there is really, you know, nothing underneath it, right? I mean, you know, it could go the other way just as quick, but it just illustrates, for me, you know, as a microcosm of what's happening more broadly in the financial markets.
Yeah, I go back to what Grantham said the other day in his newsletter. Mm. You know, that basically it's quite obvious it's a bubble, mm. but everyone, you know, pretty much everybody knows it. But it's just the fact that nobody wants to get off the ride while it's still going vertical.
Well, that's the point. And the old point is, you know, if you can pick it, then you can probably do well. It's interesting, a few more significant investors have actually now stepped on the sidelines saying, well, we rode it up and that was good, but we're now going to wait and see what happens. And, you know, wherever you look, so whether you look at stocks or whether you look at Bitcoin or, you know, other asset classes too, I mean, New Zealand, right? Look at New Zealand property, right? That's gone way through the roof, right? Again, no real justification for the amount of value that's being, quote, created, right? It's just another artificial bubble. Or even property in Australia is probably going up again as well because of it. So we've got bubble, bubble, bubble everywhere, right? But we have lost that linkage to the economic fundamentals, right? Because normally stock prices have some linkage to future earnings. Well, that's blown out the window, right? And how do you justify the value of Bitcoin other than, well, there are more people buying and selling at the moment? Bit the same with property. But it's nothing to do with fundamental value at all.
No, but I mean, the question is how long can the sort of, you know, gulf between the two be sustained? Because, you know, we are heading for this very, very difficult situation at the moment. Because, you know, if we do see this absurd stimulus in the US, it's going to prove a catalyst to either, you know, this is the new paradigm of absolute insanity, and the investors are just going to accept it, because, you know, they'd much rather their investments don't fall, or we'll see, you know, the bubble eventually collapse. I mean, you know, to go back to Grantham once again, he said sort of, you know, summer in the US, end of summer in the US. But I mean, it's really, really tough to time. I mean, that's why they say don't bother, really.
I don't think you can time it, because if the stimulus goes on getting thrown into the system, right, and the chances are the Fed will be throwing a lot more liquidity in for a long, long time, right? You know, the Reserve Bank is doing it here, quantitative easing, et cetera, et cetera. All around the world, look at the amount of central bank balance sheet growth that there's been, and it's going to continue. So that really is something which changes the understanding of how economies work and markets work. Therefore, I don't think it's possible to predict when that might end, but it probably will at some point. That's why it's so tricky, right? So that's why I run different scenarios. There's a scenario where this, you know, continues to run for quite some time and prices go higher. But there's also another scenario that says, oh, hang on, we could actually find it dropping the other way. Somewhere between those two truths is the truth. I just don't know where it is.
No, it's pretty tough. I mean, I was reading this analysis the other day. I think it was by JP Morgan, and they were saying if the US economy struggles, the Fed's going to expand its balance sheet from around $7 trillion now up to over $12 trillion. Yep. And I'm just like, and that's in the next 12 months, for God's sake.
Exactly. Yep. Well, I was reading the four, you know, sell side investment banks, and they're all basically predicting significant further Fed injections, right? You know, somewhere between 3 billion and 7 billion or more over the next 12 months. And so they're all arguing, oh, that means that stock markets will be higher, significantly higher over the next 12 months. So that's what they're all saying.
Well, the thing is it, you know, to me, at least, the conclusion I've sort of come to is that it's all psychology. It's not like they haven't. No, well, it is. I mean, you know, you look at Japan, you look at Europe over the last 30 years, they've both thrown massive amounts of money at their economies through QE. Both have much larger balance sheets than the Fed. And both of them, up until very recently, had pretty lackluster stock markets. It's only the fact that, you know, that the US market's rising, you know, and the rising tide lifts all boats. But by the same token, the fundamental, you know, sort of reality of injecting liquidity into the economy and into the market, it didn't actually work in terms of, you know, creating this sort of, you know, parabolic rise in asset prices that we've seen. I mean, look, I mean, maybe you could argue that prices would have been even lower if they didn't do it. And that is the argument used by some of QE's advocates. But, you know, by the same token, we've seen a very, very different set of outcomes with this injection of liquidity and the Fed's injections of liquidity in general compared with the BOJ or the ECB.
Well, that's absolutely true. But, you know, you've got to ask yourself, where is that liquidity going? It's not going to the real economy. It's not actually creating new jobs. It's not creating new businesses. It's not investing in the future, right? It's just inflating the value of existing stocks, shares, Bitcoin, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? That is not actually real growth.
No. No, it's not. And more than that, doing it at a time like this is just like, it's like looking at a book of how to create a revolution and just going to chapter two, you know? I mean, you've got 20 million people unemployed in America. You've got, you know, riots across the entire country, you know, not seen in probably 50 years. Hmm. And the Fed and Jerome Powell and Janet Yellen look at that and they go, yes, let's create a massive asset bubble and drive enormous inequality and have stocks at all-time highs, you know, every other night on the news, while someone's sitting there having their heat turned off because they can't afford to, they can't afford to pay their electricity bill. Hmm.
Well, it's that dichotomy, isn't it, between the real economy and real people, and the financial markets and the, you know, the few percent who actually are benefiting what's going on, and all of the statistics that I've seen highlights the ever larger tilt towards the few with a lot against the many with not much, right? And in a way, that was what Trump was sort of tapping into over the last 4 years, wasn't it? This inequality, this sense of, well, the guys over there are having fun, but we're not. Nothing has really fundamentally changed, though, and in a way that tilting is getting more extreme.
In some ways, I think, and this is probably going to be an unpopular opinion, but, you know, what's new? But I look at Trump losing the election, and I'm not entirely sure that from a broader overall, you know, sort of a long-term, say 10, 15-year perspective, if that's going to be a good thing for America overall.
Mm.
Now, I'm not saying that because I think Trump was an especially good president. He wasn't. But it's the fact that now Biden and the Democrats have to deliver on the expectations of the people. And the expectations of the people, now that they've thrown all this stuff about giving people $2,000 and, you know, unlimited government support and stuff, they've now created this series of unrealistic expectations that they cannot possibly meet.
Hmm.
So in 4 years' time, you know, what are we going to see? You know, Biden is apparently, you know, the general consensus is Biden is only going to be a one-term president because of his age. So we're going to see populism rising on both sides of US politics as the middle class and the lower classes continue to get screwed by the Fed and government policies. So you got to ask yourself, where does this end? I mean, in a way, I think it probably would have been better if Trump was replaced by someone with a bit more vision, with a bit more sort of ability to deliver on the promise of, you know, change and hope we can believe in, as Obama would say. But I'm just not sure that this is going to be such a positive in the long run. You know, you can't, sure, you've got rid of Trump, you've got rid of the stupid tweeting at 4 o'clock in the morning and, you know, randomly shit stirring and all that sort of stuff. But it doesn't change the fundamental problems for America. Those all still exist. And in a lot of ways, I think that the alliance that has formed around opposing Trump is now going to fracture, because it's going to be everyone for themselves. I mean, it's no different than in a civil war. Once one side wins, they all break off and they all start fighting with each other for control.
Yeah, well, it was clear that towards the end there was an alignment of interests in the negative sense, right? Do something about Trump, rather than the positive sense of, you know, here's an alternative narrative for how to actually take the economy forward. In fact, you know, you could argue, I think, that Biden was very much positioned as not Trump through the whole campaign, right? There wasn't a huge amount of detail in terms of what those policies might look like going forward. And so that's the first point. But the second point is, you're actually right on the things that he's actually taken a position on. Those are very big promises, and it's going to be very tough to deliver them. And, you know, you mentioned that horribly large number of people unemployed or underemployed in the US. I mean, that is a true economic nightmare that is really going to play out, and it's going to play out on the streets, not just in the financial markets.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, to sort of, you know, go back to my, you know, original niche when I started all this history, people forget that back in sort of mid-1929, Germany was prosperous. Germany had one of the most integrated populations in Europe. It had one of the highest rates of intermarriage between Jews and, you know, non-Jews in the world. And then it went from that to Hitler being in charge in less than 4 years. Everything went pear-shaped so quickly because of the Depression. And that is the sort of, you know, situation that we potentially face. I mean, if we did exactly what Germany did in the late 1920s, early 1930s, we would have a depression right now. If we didn't throw all this trillion, tens of trillions of dollars, we'd be sitting here talking about a depression. You know, it really is that simple. And we still face, you know, a long-term economic crunch, whether you want to call it a depression or a long-term, you know, sort of real economy recession. You know, it just depends on how you define it. But it just really goes to show how quickly things can go downhill. You know, they're storming the Capitol with their stupid Viking hats today, but what is it going to look like a year from now or 5 years from now?
Well, let me tell you about my K theory, right? Because I think we've got a K-shaped recovery going on at the moment, right? But what that means is we've got some parts of the economy doing reasonably well, and we've got other parts of the economy doing very, very badly, right? Now, the part of the economy that's doing reasonably well are people who've got money invested in stocks and shares, money invested in property, et cetera, et cetera. And quite a few of them are actually saying, well, I don't think my job got hit by the COVID over the last 9 months to a year. I'm fine, you know. So they're doing quite well, right? It's the others who actually have lost their job, lost their hours, the gig economy workers, the self-employed people who never got any support, right, who are seeing things getting worse and worse and worse. That's a lot of small and medium enterprises in Australia as well in that same category, right? But what's interesting is if you look at the weight of numbers, right, there is slightly more in the upper leg of the K than the lower leg of the K. Sufficient, I think, that if there was an election held later in the year, and it's probably October from what I'm reading in terms of we know when it could be, there is enough support to get ScoMo back from those who are actually feeling positive about what's currently going on. Never mind the lower leg of the K, which is continuing to decay and will continue to decay into the future. Now, that's how I'm looking at the economy. So it's not one economy, it's two economies. And it's very much two narratives, right? But all of the conversation is in the upper narrative, upper leg of the K. That's where all the sort of enthusiasm and positivity lies. The lower the leg of the K is where the real issue is. And that is where I think the seeds of potential destruction later are actually being laid now.
I don't think much has changed, as silly as that may sound. The number of people in the lower leg of the K has changed. Yep. That's expanded significantly. Yep. But the people in those situations, people who are struggling, you know, people who have on lower incomes, on welfare, you know, people who have all manner of, you know, issues, whether it's mental health or substance abuse or whatever, they've, you know, that those ranks have grown exponentially since the start of the year.
Yep.
And really, those people are being treated the same way they've been treated for the last 40 years. Mm. That, you know, maybe not 30, probably more like 25 years, you know, since Howard. But, you know, that's roughly, you know, things are roughly the same as they have been. Mm. It's frustrating to watch. I agree with you on that. But, and you're right, I don't think it is going to change. Realistically, unless Labor come up with some great, you know, Kevin 07-esque plan to win the election or change leaders and just find a different niche to appeal to voters, I think you're probably right. I think it is definitely Scott Morrison's election to lose. But it is just concerning watching all this play out. I mean, to be honest, generally speaking, I think Australians are probably too apathetic to really do anything for the most part. I think things will have to go cataclysmically wrong before you do see a critical mass of people out there in the streets in the way that you'd see it in Italy or Greece or Spain. But I think that realistically at this point, Australia's biggest issues are probably, at least in, say, the next 12 to 24 months, they're not actually domestic, they're global. Because for the next, say, you know, 12, 24 months, they're going to be throwing so much more stimulus at the economy that it's not really going to, you know, we're not really going to see a super large downturn. Because at the end of the day, even if we do start to see the beginnings of a downturn, as you say, they're just going to throw more money at it. And because they have the scope for it. Mm. But if we do see, you know, financial market jitters return, as many predict they will, sometime later this year, whether it's the Northern Hemisphere summer or whether it's later in the year, then that could really, you know, hit things for six. I mean, and then only that, but there's also the issue of rising bond yields as well. If we do start to see bond yields really take off and the RBA gets forced to raise interest rates, oh, God. You know, that'd be fun.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a huge amount of likelihood of that in the short term. But, you know, who knows with all of the stuff that's going off in the US at the moment. I guess my point would be that with those two camps, as it were, right, what's really interesting is that in my surveys, I even see confidence levels very different in those in the upper leg and the lower leg, right? And you know, the asset distribution is very different in the two legs. So you've still got this, well, let's call them underclass for something to call them, right? The people who are effectively doing it tough, have always done it tough, are doing it even tougher now, right? And I guess my question is, who's got their back and who's representing them in dialogue and debate in the country?
Well, I suppose realistically, to be completely honest with you, it's probably the journos and the people in the media, the few people who do place their focus on that. You know, there are a few of them out there. People like Dave Donovan from Independent Australia or Michael West. Mm. You know, they do a great job, you know, covering all that sort of stuff. But you know, in terms of the mainstream, like you say, it's mostly the positive, you know, economic hype driven agenda. And realistically, in government, I mean, look, don't get me wrong, the Greens. On these issues, you know, there's like, say, Senator Rachel Seward. She did a great job covering all this sort of stuff. But the problem is that the Greens, you know, sort of, shall we say, you know, their positive attributes when it comes to, you know, things like welfare and stuff like that ends up getting drowned out by all the other stuff. whether, you know, you can argue all you like, but that's what happens in the media. Whether you think it happens or not, you know, and from an overall perspective is a matter of opinion. But realistically, there's not really anyone on a large scale standing up for these people who need to be heard.
Right. And if I think of it in terms of the main political power blocks, right, I would argue that both Labour and the Liberal Nationals are sort of much more focused on the upper leg of the K than the lower leg of the K, despite what they might say.
The upper leg of the K is where you win elections.
That's the point.
To be completely honest with you.
Yes.
You know, that's it. You know, I mean, and it's not just the fact that it's the majority. It's the fact that that's where swing voters live.
Yep.
You know, if you're someone who's been hammered by the welfare system, it's not going to be likely that you're going to turn around and vote for Scott Morrison, who's told you that the best form of welfare is a job, when you've got laid off in your late 50s and you've been trying for 4 or 5 years to find a job and you haven't been able to despite your best efforts. You're not going to turn around and vote for him after he's been disparaging you, you know, albeit indirectly. And it just doesn't look good, to be completely frank with you. I mean, like, I look at Australia and I was like, well, crap, we've got problems. Then I look at the rest of the world, you know, especially the Americans, and it's like, you know, this is recipe for revolution stuff. It's like, I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to happen anytime soon. You know, this sort of stuff takes time. Mm. But by the same token, if you look at, say, the Arab Spring, it happens very slowly and then all at once.
Mm. But you see, the point, I think, is that the neoliberal philosophy, which is underpinning both sides of politics in Australia, right, is very strongly aligned to the upper leg of the K, right? And you can see the same things happening again, you know, effectively debt. More debt is good, even more debt is better. You know, people can actually bring forward stuff into the future. All of that stuff is there. You know, the companies are behaving the same way. So there is a fundamental set of doctrines that underpin both sides of politics, right? So they're not actually on opposite side of the fence on this. They're actually on the same side of the fence, right? But the thing I'm concerned about is the implications of that for the rest of society. And I guess, you know, somewhere at some point there has to be a discussion about inclusivity and the, you know, what is society for? Is society really for making a proportion of it ever more affluent and, you know, forgetting about everybody else? Or is there an alternative narrative that says a more inclusive strategy should be there? And I guess that takes me to sort of come back to quite often, which is, what are we here for?
The problem, as I see it, is that, you know, while I agree with you that we need to have that discussion when we should be having it now, or frankly, we should have been having it more than a decade ago,
no.
The question is, do the politicians believe that we need to have that discussion?
No.
I would wager the answer is no.
No, they don't, because they're putting all their effort in that upper leg of the K, right? And there's enough there to actually win an election on.
Yeah, but that's the problem. It's going to keep going like that. I mean, you know, realistically, you know, the issues that we're experiencing now is probably the US, what, say 15, 20 years ago. Hmm. You know, we're starting to see the same similar problems, you know, the unemployed being neglected, you know, an explosion in the number of homeless people, all these issues that the US was experiencing in the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, we're starting to experience now.
Hmm.
And, you know, they didn't do anything there. And you know, eventually you ended up with a Trump. And the same thing's going to happen here. I mean, you know, you've already got voters who feel disenfranchised, who turned around in the last couple of elections and voted for Clive Palmer or Mark Latham or Pauline Hanson. And people are angry. Mm. And and this is one thing that frustrates me about elements of the media sometimes. They look at it and they go, oh, people voted for Palmer or for Latham or for Hanson because they're racist. Look, sure, racist people exist out there. Absolutely. That's true. No one's going to dispute that. But a lot of people voted for them because they're angry, because they feel like the Liberal Party and the Labor Party don't represent them, their views, their interests. And that's something that is really, you know, needs to change. And I think that that's something that the Liberal Party and the Labor Party really need to keep in mind going forward. I think they've probably got this next election cycle that they'll get through that just fine. But after that, if you know, this sort of K-shaped recovery continues and people continue to feel disenfranchised, it's ripe for a third party populist to step in and just wreck the political spectrum as we know it.
Mm, yeah, it certainly could well be a significant disruption later. Let me sort of reflect on something else. I came to Australia in 1995, right? I came from the UK, having lived there previously. And when I came to Australia, I was amazed at a couple of things. Firstly, that they actually had a joined up transport system so that the ferries actually connected with the buses that connected with the trains, right? In the UK, that had died years and years ago, so that the public transport system was nowhere. The other one, it was more egalitarian here. There was a more of a sense of, shared community, shared values, right? And what I've seen over that, past 20 years or so is those things which I think made Australia significantly different and positively so get degraded and degraded and degraded. So effectively, we've followed the path of the UK or the US to the point where we're seeing this bifurcation that I'm talking about now, right? So unfortunately, that is the journey that we are on, which suggests that the outcome is going to be somewhat similar to a Boris Johnson in the UK or a Trump in the US.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, I think that compulsory voting will probably and preferential voting will probably help to keep things more towards the middle, relatively speaking. Mm. But it is definitely going to become complicated quite quickly if you see a third party populist rising through the ranks because of the way the Senate works. Mm. And you could very quickly see third party populist, taking the balance of power. But one thing I've always looked at Australian society ever since I was a kid, this is sort of, 25 years ago now, I remember thinking to myself how different it was to sort of how humans have lived historically. Most civilizations, the vast majority of them, are extremely unfair. They're largely feudal, aristocratic, hierarchical societies defined by your birth. And I always thought, isn't it great that Australia is different? Isn't it great that, that we've got social mobility, we've got all these different things. But, now I look at things and I just think that things are really that different. And that really does make me wonder sometimes that, humans do sort of tend to accept that type of society, accept that type of life. And I just wonder that, say, especially in the US, have we just been worn down to the point where we're just going to turn around and go, oh, well, this isn't that great, but, I've got my $2,000 check and, things could be worse. So, yeah, I'll just deal with it.
Well, that's right. And my worry, again, is a bit like yours, that perhaps we are more willing now to accept poor quality compromise outcomes rather than actually taking a stance and taking a position that actually has the potential to create, more value for more of society later. But it comes right back to my key question is, what is society for? What is this whole thing about, right? Because is it really about the concentration of value to a small part of the community, or is it to maximize the benefit of the total community, right? Because those two things are pulling in very different directions.
To be honest, I think what we need to do is ban political donations and give politicians enormous pensions for life under the condition that they never work again unless they work for a non-profit organization. That's what I'd like to see, to be completely honest with you. I don't care if it costs us $5 billion a year in poly pensions. We'd still end up being better off, because at least then they're not doing it in order to get some cushy job after they finish their time in office. Because that's the problem. You look at the boards of these companies, these big ASX listed companies, and it's like, well, that's a former minister, former minister, former minister, and it's like, well, I'm sure they're there solely on their merits and not the fact that they're connected to the political class at all. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure some of them are very, very talented folks, but from what I've heard, some of them are less than stellar.
Well, there is certainly a gamble hopscotch in town, I think, where people go from one sort of type of role in politics to various other roles in the private sector and actually, are able to benefit from that. Like I said, there is a section of the population that's doing really well, thank you, and, are enjoying the wealth that's being created and enjoying the machines that have been created, metaphorical social machines. But I just worry about who's looking after the rest. And I'm sorry, but I don't see enough focus on that broader question. And I really am disturbed and concerned that the things that we saw in the US in the last two or three days is a harbinger, not just for them, but potentially for us later. So that's why I'm very concerned at the moment.
This may sound really horrible, but here we go. I'm known for that anyway, but here we go. I honestly would love to see people get angry enough to do that, to be completely honest with you, to actually not necessarily break into parliament and go mess up all their crap, but to be angry enough to actually act, to be angry enough to get together as a movement to actually tell the politicians that enough is enough. And that is something that we deeply, deeply need in this country, because everyone just seems so just happy enough to just kick back and watch the TV they bought with Afterpay, and eat their meals that are funded by JobKeeper, and just watch The Bachelor.
Yep. Well, A is for apathy, and A is for Australia.
I think, to be honest, we've had it so good for so long. Yep. I think about, say, for example, like my quality of life growing up relative, in terms of what the government provided, a decent school, we had, one of the best quality health systems in the world. We had, wide open spaces where kids could play. We played cricket and soccer in the street and didn't have to worry. You went on day trips with your parents out to, Mount Dandenong or Cape Shankill or whatever without having to sit in traffic for 1,000,000,000 years. And that's gone. That's dead.
Yep.
I often, drive into like an Australian capital, because I'm a driving sort of guy, and I often drive into an Australian capital after a couple of years of not being there, and I just think, holy crap,
yep,
this has gotten so much worse. And because we're all like the frog in the boiling water, we don't realize that, oh my God, traffic has gotten horrible, and now there's 35 kids in my kid's class, and they're not getting the help that they need, and it's just, and we vote for the same bloody people anyway. It's just like, all right, it's democracy. You do that. That's fine.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting question, because a lot of people do recognize some of the things you're talking about and what we've been talking about, as significant issues. But then it's a bit hard, and the sun's shining, and there's stuff on the TV, and I'll just go and watch that and forget about it, right? I'm a great believer in taking an initiative and, making a fuss and trying to get some of these issues more broadly tabled, because I think that's critically important for our future. Because without it, we're just going to become more and more debilitated as a society and more polarized as a society, and less able to do the sorts of things that, we would aspire to do or could do 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah. And just to sort of, go off on a little bit of a personal rant for a moment, I'm getting kind of sick of my generation being thrown under the bus, to be completely honest with you.
Fair enough.
We get thrown under the bus on housing affordability. We get thrown under the bus on living standards. And then as all the baby boomers retire, we're gonna be the ones who pay the taxes, who are gonna have to foot the bill for them in their retirement. And it just, my dad used to work in finance back in the 80s, and I remember telling me stories when I was a kid about how horrible the dependency ratios were going to be in Australia once we hit sort of, the 2010s, 2020s and so forth, and it was only going to get worse and worse for a long, long time to come, and that basically my generation was going to be saddled with all these horrible taxes to pay for the retirements and the health cares of the boomer generation. And here we are. We've known this is coming. My dad was a finance guy. I can only imagine that this has been common knowledge at Treasury for 30 years, and we've done nothing.
Well, there's an intergenerational report that's done every few years, right? And it's been calling out this stuff for at least 15 to 20 years, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All the data is there.
Correct.
So this generation, my generation is being completely thrown under the bus. We have to deal with the higher taxes, the higher housing prices, and if you don't like it, you can, what do they say? If you don't love it, leave it. And it just gets me, because at the end of the day, like, a lot of this stuff is already baked in. You know, there's nothing that we can do about things like dependency ratios. We're stuffed on that. But it would be nice to be able to maybe at least get an affordable house while I pay the excessive taxes to fund my parents' pensions.
Yeah. Now, I'm afraid that the intergenerational stuff is, you know, very significant. And what I find quite interesting is that there is a sense amongst some younger people of, but that's just the way it is, right? You know, because they've, well, you know, when they went to university, they got a big debt. They're expected to have a big debt for their mortgage. You know, they'll have credit cards, so that they're wired to think that debt is just the way it is, right? It doesn't have to be like that, right? There is a set of determinants that actually are wired into the way society is, and that's the outcome. But the point is, those are actually things that could be changed if there was an intent to change them. The question is there enough intent, and is there enough interest amongst those in positions of power to address some of these issues? And the answer is no. The only way that's going to change is if those who actually are actually exposed to some of these issues begin to actually make a little bit more of a fuss and use the democratic process a little bit more to actually make sure that politicians and those in positions of power actually understand that all is not well.
Well, it really makes me understand why, you know, like, I talk to people in my sort of age group about all of this, and people would despise them for thinking this, but they're just like, they just say to me, I'm so hoping for a housing crash. I'm hoping that we have a financial meteor that just completely guts the whole bloody thing and forces a reset, because realistically for that, that is their only hope. To ever have the kind of life that their parents enjoyed, and that's just horrible. I'm sorry, you know, all these, you know, people can say, oh, it's so fantastic that housing prices are rising. I'm sorry, but get stuffed, you know. No, seriously, there is proof from the Bank of International Settlements and the RBA that if housing prices keep rising due to household debt, that basically people don't have enough money to go out there and spend.
Yep.
So basically the economy stagnates and you end up with the Australia that we had in 2019.
Yep.
So how is that positive? It's not. It's like, are you people idiots? You know, you've got this evidence staring you in the face, but you're like, oh, but the wealth effect.
I don't know whether you know The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I do.
It is a brilliant series, right? But there's a thing in there called the Shu Event Horizon. And I just want to take you through that, because there's a wonderful analogy between the Shu Event Horizon and property, right? Basically, the story goes like this. There's the particular planet, right, where there's an economy, but over time, more and more of the economy is actually to do with shoe shops and selling shoes, right? Because that's actually what everybody wants. So essentially, over time, there are more and more and more and more shoe shops, right? And then there is the shoe event horizon, where the only thing actually is there is shoe shops. So the whole society collapses. And then a million years later, you can go back and you can see in the sort of the bedrock, right, the line of the shoe event horizon, right? I think, well, we are in the property event horizon even now, because more and more and more of the society, banks, money, debt is aligned to property, right? But the result of that is potential, we're getting closer and closer to that equivalent of, you know, the property event horizon, let's call it, right? I mean, that's a serious point. That effectively it completely distorts the broader economy.
It does. And one of the things that gets me is that one of the reasons why household debt hasn't completely exploded further into the stratosphere is because we've seen low turnover volumes and low levels of first home buyers buying properties between sort of after the end of the Rudd first homeowners grant and probably last year. And now we're seeing this big rise in the number of first home buyers and people buying properties again, particularly in the December quarter. And I just look at it and I think, okay, we're already at 121% of household debt to GDP. And I just think to myself, okay, let's say hypothetically, you know, the government does get their big uptick in first home buyers, that we see a similar proportion of the first home buyer population run out to buy a property like they did during the Rudd homeowners grant. Household debt is going to go through the roof. We're going to further kneecap our economy, and all these people who are going to be having these enormous mortgages, you know, that they, you know, especially the people who go in there and they can only just about service it. What's going to happen then? You know, so on one hand, you're going to have an economy with the lowest rates in history, where rates can basically can't go any lower over the long term. Maybe, you know, maybe we'll get negative rates that go a little bit lower for a short period, but you know, rates will eventually rise at some point in the next 20 to 30 years of these people's mortgages. And on the other hand, you've got the highest household debt, you know, by then probably the highest household debt level in the world, and evidence from some of the preeminent authorities on these types of things, like the Bank of International Settlements, that's going to kneecap your economic growth. It's just it sounds like a recipe for ritual Japanese economic suicide. You know, just
except much more slowly.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Over decades, it's just, you know, yeah. Slow motion.
Exactly right. Look at Japan. Well, no, that is precisely the point. And so the issues we're talking about underscore the fact that this is a long, slow thing that we're in the middle of, right? And I know the virus is in the middle of it, and that's creating some immediate issues. But underlying it, you've got all of these structural issues that are actually still there and are still, frankly, eating away at the heart of our economy and, you know, frankly, society. And that is where the focus should be, in my view, in terms of trying to deal with some of the broader issues, rather than, frankly, throwing every bit of stimulus at just short-term support for the economy on the hope that somehow it magically gets beyond the next election.
Well, that's it, isn't it? But that's what we're doing around the world, though, isn't it? Yep. You know, I mean, you know, it's like, I think it was Jeffrey Gundlach, you know, the Bond King, or, you know, well, the Bond King who rivals Steve Van Meter. You know, I'm not sure who he'd say was the Bond King, but anyway, you know, like he was saying, you know, that all this money you're throwing at the economy, will it boost nominal GDP? Sure, it will. Of course, it will. People are out there going, they're going to go out with their $2,000 stimulus checks or $2,000 a month or whatever it is, and they're going to go out and they're going to buy stuff, of course. But is that actually going to create long-term economic growth? No. It's going to create a great short-term sugar hit. Maybe it'll save some jobs for in the short term in the process, but it's not laying a foundation for the future.
No.
It's just more debt.
That's exactly right. And the foundation for the future, as we've said on a few past occasions, is the critical question. I think at the moment that's probably the biggest gap from a policy perspective that we got in Australia and around the world. And frankly, unless that does get addressed, we're going to continue to see more and more negativity ultimately. So, you know, same old, same old. What we saw last year, we'll see this year and probably the next year or two. But at some point, chickens are going to come home to roost.
Yeah, I agree. And I do wonder, like, just when exactly that is going to occur, because there is a fiscally conservative streak here in Australia, even in the Labor Party. You know, I mean, you know, they were talking up their stimulus about raising revenue through, you know, ending, you know, franking credit cash refunds and, you know, negative gearing and all that sort of stuff, and, you know, recouping some cash for the Treasury. But I do wonder how much longer we're going to sort of see this impetus here in Australia to continue to throw money at the economy, because there's already disquiet in the Liberal Party room. They'd love to get rid of all this JobKeeper and all this other stuff. I mean, you know, I mean, look at what they did for a couple of $100 million with robo debt, for God's sake. You know, JobKeeper's costing more than that every couple of days, maybe every week.
Mm. No, well, that's true too, yes. Well, there is, I think, some interesting polarisation going on, but I suspect that the short-term plan is next election. We'll worry about it after right? That's where it is.
Oh, definitely. Yep. I mean, it's all about the next election. Yep. If they can have JobKeeper, I mean, the ideal, I think, would be if they can have JobKeeper still on, say they extend it for 6 months, they have the election in, say, you know, sort of mid-August, they've still got JobKeeper on, everyone still thinks it's hunky-dory, ScoMo's going to support me till kingdom come. Then they've got another 3 years to just unwind it, or even just, you know, cold turkey, that's it, you know, thanks for all the fish. And then just, and then, you know, they've got 3 years after that for the economy to rebound.
Thanks for all the fish is, of course, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, it is.
I think that's probably the message for today, folks. If you really want to know about what's going on, read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. It's probably one of the most brilliant books ever written.
It's going to be an interesting year, mate. It certainly, is.
Well, we'll catch up again soon and continue to pull the eyes out of it as we go forward. I think there'll be some interesting repetition of some of these critical themes, but things are definitely not necessarily on the improve based on what I'm seeing at the moment.
No, unfortunately not. We'll just have to wait and see exactly how it is when we finally pull back the curtain and see the how the mighty Oz is actually faring.
Okay, well, we'll pull back the curtain some more next time. Tarek, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
No worries, mate. See you soon.
See you. Bye.